Roth Radio, 6 a.m. Well, it's not 6 anymore. Partnership for a Brain-Free America. My most esteemed uncle, Manny Roth, here, telling us a little bit about the history of downtown New York City. This fellow is a great big part of the reason why I went into show business and why I have the general bottomless cup of attitude, and the second one's free. Buddy, my friend, my uncle, Manny Roth.
Hey, David, let's fast forward a little bit here now. I opened, needless to say, the original cafe that I opened didn't pan out exactly the way I planned. I didn't do many shows because I started to make a buck, right? So then let's fast forward to the cafe wall. Oh, but I did meet some very interesting characters. You know who opened right across the street from me at the same time I opened my first place? Art Lugoff, who had the Village Gate. Art and I are a very long-time friend, and he had every jazz great in the world.
Name some of those names. Which jazz greats at that point in time?
Well, I'm not the authority on jazz greats.
What year was
you
it?
You name them.
Okay, well, what
Mulligan,
year?
Mulligan, Miles.
What year was it, man?
This was 58, 59.
Okay, this is the classic Blue Note album cover series. Is there everything that you see here on these walls? You know, Stanley Turrentine and all of these kinds of guys. The classics. Okay.
The greats, the really greats. Anyway, about this time, the opportunity to open the Café Bois came along. It was supposed to be a joke on me. Somebody sent this guy over to me to sell me this basement.
That basement is still there. That basement is packed four nights a week, still there.
Yeah, the basement on McDougal Street. And I went. You know what that basement was? It was a stable.
I know that the doors on the other side look like that.
Well, they had a ramp going down from McDougal Street where the horses could go in, and they had a trough running down the center of the room there to eliminate all the waste that happened with horses in the room. Anyway, it's this huge room on McDougal Street underneath the Players Theater. The guy bought the building to put in a theater, and he didn't do anything with the basement. And the brokers came around looking for some schmuck to do something with the basement there, and I turned out to be the guy.
Why did you name it the Café Bois?
Because I couldn't think of anything else. I kept coming up with names every time everybody would volunteer a name. Every name I heard, I'd say, wow. And it had no theme, so I couldn't think of a theme. I couldn't think of a Grand Guignol theme, you know. So I figured, well, hell, let's just make it a bag of everything. It won't have anything. People will walk in, they'll look around, and they'll say, wow.
Tonight, history for all the wrong reasons, my special guest, Manny Roth.
So wow. We did that. We hung a lot of detritus and a lot of garbage and a lot of junk around the room. And you know what I did for a ceiling? I went out and I bought some yardage of burlap. Now, I'm just lucky the place didn't burn down. Yeah, but there was no ceiling between me and the theater. It was just a raw ceiling.
Okay.
So I took that burlap and I strung it. I nailed it up. I did this. I got dirty. I nailed it up there, and I took some spray cans and I sprayed the burlap. And it looked colorful. It looked great. But it had to be dangerous, man. It had to be dangerous.
That was the thrill of that time.
I mean, any spark would have ignited that burlap. And what did I do for a floor? I went out. Tommy Ziegler, who owned the Figaro, told me he had a marble floor. Well, that sounded great to me. How do you get a marble floor? Well, you go out to the place where they make marble, and you load up a truck of junk marble, you know, bits and pieces,
sure,
and chunks.
And you fit that together on the floor.
And they dumped a few trucks full down at the Café Bois. And I got dirty again. I got down on my hands and knees.
Is that floor still there?
That floor is still there.
There's a million people have walked across that floor. How many acts played at the Café Wa in the time that you worked
there? 20 years that I was there, I would get 8,000, 10,000acts.
Really?
Yeah.
And what kind of acts played at the Café Wa, Manny?
Well, let's start from the beginning. First of all, I didn't have any lights. I didn't have any sound system. The folk singers would come in and sit around and do their thing. And the first day I opened it on a Thursday. And it was a place, it was a sight to behold.
Was it full right off the bat? Was it popular right off the bat?
I took in $8 on Thursday. But
I have the same agent. Who was the first act to play? What did they do? What did they say? Tell me what they did.
Well, I was still the first act. I would get up there and just...
There's that Roth thing.
Just horse around with the audience. And for the first people to play were the poets.
People reading
and
poetry.
And the folk singers. Well, the folk singers would sit around there and they would do their thing. And then little by little, I gradually built a little stage. I put in lights. And I put in a sound system. And then a more expensive sound system and a recording system. And I had an elaborate setup there. And little by little, the folkies got up. They started doing their numbers. And I still wasn't making any money there because the people were coming in. They were buying 35-cent coffee and 50-cent sodas. So I started charging at the door. Started charging a quarter.
just to get 25 cents to get in.
Well, they're coming over from all the bridge and tunnel crowd and all the tourists. You know, the village is...
And there's 25 cents to get in.
25 cents.
1958?
Then I figure, hey, I gotta do more than that. No resistance. So I raised it to 50 cents. No resistance. I raised it to a dollar. Hey, holy cow. The sky's the limit here. So I raised it to $2.
And up come a bubbling crew.
I raised it to $3.
Old Jed's a millionaire.
Yeah. And back then, back in the 60s, $3 was...
That was mad. That was mad that large. Was in $3.50 to go to a movie late 60s.
And on the weekends, I was doing like three shows an evening. And it was a big place. I seated over 200.
It's still it's the same, exact same as you go now. You can see the Café Wa exactly, almost it's preserved as it probably was exactly.
So that's how it took shape. And you want to hear some of the people I had down there?
Tell us some of the names that passed through the Café Wa.
Lou Gossett Jr. was probably my first Canadian. Manny, let's do a Hootenanny.
Lou Gossett Jr.
Lou
the actor?
Gossett Jr. A black actor from the Negro Ensemble Theater from the East Side. They had he was in A Raisin in the Sun.
Okay, well, don't we have a Lou Gossett? Is that Lou Gossett Jr.?
In the movies, yeah, Lou Gossett.
It was his father.
No. This was Lou Gossett.
Oh, okay.
There's only one Lou Gossett. And Godfrey Cambridge. You know who
he is? Oh, sure, absolutely. And, from Watermelon Man.
Yeah. And they said, let's do a hoot.
Like a Hootenanny?
Hootenanny, yeah.
What's a Hootenanny?
Hootenanny is where you have an open mic, where wannabes come in, they sign up, and they do their thing.
It's like open mic now.
Yeah, open mic. They mostly folk singers, few poets, anybody who wants to do something. We had a saying, come on down here to the hoot. Come on down, do your thing. We don't care what it is you do, just do it here. And every Monday night we had a hoot. And
for how many years did you have that?
Oh, it was ongoing. It was ongoing. And
did you discover anybody that we were doing during that open night?
Oh yeah. Well, I saw Dylan up there.
Bob Dylan showed up on Mike night.
Oh, absolutely. And I made first of all, Dylan came in. He had just hit the village. And
what year was this, Manny?
This had to be. Oh, early 60s, 61, 62. Yeah, somewhere in there. And he comes to me and he said,
this name, Bob Dylan comes
Bob
to
Dylan. Well, no, it was Bob Zimmerman. There's a difference.
Well, not now, but... You knew that totem pole when he was just a tree stump.
Well, yeah. He said, I'm new in town here. He said, I need a place to crash. So I got up on the stage and I said, we got this new kid in town here, and he needs a place to crash. And somebody took him home. And he found a place to sleep. Anyway,
Did he come back to play for you?
Oh, yeah. He came back. He did the hoots. And I made an instant judgment. I knew right away, this kid will never make it. I'm saying to myself, this kid can't play. He can't sing. He had no stage presence. This kid doesn't have a friggin' prayer. And then, lo and behold, he's following Al Grossman around. Al Grossman's his manager.
Okay.
He also managed Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Did Peter, Paul, and Mary play at the Wah?
Well, Peter and Paul played the singles. Mary was a waitress.
Oh, really? Yeah. So they joined up, the three had to go commercial,
yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. Anyway, there, before you know it, Dylan writes, who knew that he wrote? I didn't know. Anyway, Al Grossman's his man. And he writes this song, "The Ants Are My Friends." Right? Whoever, "The Ants Are My Friends," right? And it becomes a big, big hit. You don't know the song? "The Ants Are My Friends" is blowing in the wind.
"The Ants Are My Friends." And they're blowing in the wind. History for all the wrong reasons. We're talking to Manny Roth, my most esteemed uncle, who is visiting us, the godfather of the village, who will always remain, and he's the patriarch of the Roth family, a big part of the reason I got into showbiz. We're talking about Bob Dylan here. Did you actually fire Bob for being late? That's kind of one of the...
Well, I never used him. I never used him. He wasn't good enough.
And he wrote that song, and that song became popular at that time. Then.
Yeah, that was one of his first.
Friends.
Yeah, and then Peter, Paul, and Mary came along. Pete Yarrows and Noel Stuckey played for me his single. Pete Yarrows is just the same Pete Yarrows you see today. He was a foot stomper. I mean, he could get the crowd going. And he was good.
Is he an acoustic guitar player?
Guitar player. He was from Cornell. And I think he had written that song, song?
Peter, Paul, and Mary? Is Puff the Magic Dragon?
Puff the Magic Dragon. He had written that while he was in Cornell, I think. And that was one of their first.
Were people smoking pot in 1961?
Are you kidding?
No. Tell me. Talk to me.
I'm living proof.
Of? Was that was pretty common?
Pretty common, yeah. But the penalty for pot back then was crazy. I mean, they put you away.
Like what? For one joint, if you got caught?
For one joint, they put you away for life. No, I'm saying, maybe not for life, but you would do a term if you had a certain amount of pot on you.
Okay.
But luckily, I tried to stay clean, David.
And were you successful?
As far as the authorities were concerned, I was successful. Over the years, there were a lot of people. Like I say, there must have been 8,000-10,000 acts across my stage. And I'm going to read you a few of the names. You stop me now.
Go ahead, we'll check in on some.
It goes on forever.
Swing on some.
Remember now, every name that I mentioned, not one story, got a dozen stories.
Okay, go with the names here. Go ahead.
Anyway, start out with Bill Cosby.
Right there. Let's hear the story.
I'd rather tell you stories about the next one, Richie Pryor.
Go with Richard Pryor. Well, Richard just passed away, and that's
Richie
kind of a loss here.
Away. I was Richie's first manager.
Yeah. What year was that?
That had to be like 63.
Really? Richard Pryor came to New York?
Pryor came to New York, and he was directed to the Café Wah because I was the man, they said. And I had the venue. And I didn't hire him directly. I happened to be down in Miami on a vacation, and my then manager, Big John, there's another story, hired Richie and put him to work. Yeah, anybody that walked in the door and said, I'm a comic, you put them to work, because comedy wasn't a cottage industry back then. There weren't comedy clubs all over the country back then. There were just a handful of venues in the village. There was me, the Bitter End, the Gaslight, and maybe the Phase too.
And everywhere that did music also did comedy at the same time.
Oh, mixed bag, whatever was happening. I did everything too.
I remember the first time that I came to the Cafe Wow was the summer of 1961, and Virgin Island steel drum bands were all the rage then.
Steel drums went on forever.
Oh,
because they were a staple.
Oh, that was constant. The first time I walked into that club, I remember sitting at the in the back of the club as, what was I, 7 years old? I remember the visual absolutely like it was yesterday. We sat at park benches, and we ate ice cream sundaes, and the Virgin Island steel drummers were whipping it up. That was the face of tropical music. That was, you know, what it meant in hot weather, huh?
And I took you around and showed you the cafe, Cafe Bois, and I said, if there's anything you want some ice cream, just dip your finger in and help yourself.
I remember
whatever you want.
I remember exactly what it looked like down there. And everybody held you up like the king. It was my first vision of show business from the inside out. And when you became Richard Pryor's manager, how old was Richie?
Richie was right out of Peoria. He had to be like 22, 23 years old.
And what was his comedy like at that time?
Wasn't Richie Pryor then. Richie was doing generic stuff. And the king of McDougal Street was Bill Cosby. Cosby was on the street at the same time. And
he was roughly the same age then. He was just out of college.
Cosby was right out of Temple, and Cosby had been a football player, and I guess he'd done some performing before.
Did he perform at the Cafe Wa?
Oh, did he ever? He performed everywhere, but he performed primarily at the Cafe Wa and at the Gaslight.
How many times do you think he performed for you?
Oh, for a couple of years, he would do like a couple of sets a night.
Really?
And yeah. And on the weekend, he would go around the village. He would do a couple of sets for me. He would do a couple of sets for the Gaslight. He'd do a couple of sets for the Bitter End. Maybe go over to the Phase Two. By the time he was done, he's done 6 to 8 sets.
And what was his comedy? Was his routine much like what exists today?
It changed. He was doing generic black stuff. White president.
What's generic black stuff in 1962?
First white president. I can't remember any of the routines, but he wasn't into the family yet because he wasn't married, you know, but he was straight arrow. I hung out with Bill a little bit. We used to sit around the Figaro and talk, and we'd go to the movies occasionally, and there wasn't much craziness. He was pretty much all business.
And with Richard Pryor?
Richard was all craziness.
Describe craziness in 1961.
Oh, well, he jumped off the stage and stabbed a customer who was heckling him with a fork.
Really?
Really.
Were there lawsuits back then?
No. We just buried the bodies and nobody asked any questions back
I'd
then.
I'd love it. If only certain things could have remained the same. Hit it off, Hutch.
David Lee Roth in the mornings.
Roth, 6 a.m. I've got a very special guest here, very important to why I got into show business. Here's the patriarch of the whole Roth family. He's Manny Roth, Uncle Manny.
Hi, we're on again.
Yes, Swing. Tell me some more of these people who were showing up through the Cafe
Wa. Don't stop me now, because there's a long list. Stop me if we run out of time.
Go ahead. This is early 60s, 1961.
Yeah. Bill Cosby, Richie Pryor, Jimi Hendrix, but he wasn't Jimi Hendrix back then. He was Jimmy James and the Blue Flames, but he was still eating the guitar and playing it behind his back.
He showed up at the Y. He played through the Y.
And he played for a long time, played for a better part of a year, till he went over to the Café Agogo, and that's another story. But to continue here, Woody Allen played.
How many times did Woody Allen work through the Café Y?
Well, they came down. I had a comic by the name of Murray Roman playing for me. So I begged off, and I helped take him over to the bitter end.
And that was his home for a while.
And that was his real home. But he was around, and they would all come in. They would all do an occasional set. Anyway, Woody Allen, Richie Havens. You know who Richie Havens is.
The one who kicked off the Woodstock movie.
Without the teeth. And there was Peter, Paul, and Mary, I told you.
Didn't they play at your wedding?
Peter and Paul, I think Peter, Paul, and Mary were at the wedding.
It made a big impression, huh?
Yeah, but there were so many, man. It was such a wild affair. No, that's another story. Then there was Bobby Klein, Dick Cavett, Phil Oakes, Fred Neil. You know who Fred Neil is?
Tell me who Fred Neil
Fred
was.
Fred Neil wrote the theme for Midnight Cowboy.
Oh, everybody's talking at me.
Yeah,
that's
can't
hear a word
that's Fred Neil. Yeah, great guy. Because there was a time when the folk singers picketed me. They wanted more money.
And so they had a strike.
They went on strike, yeah.
Did you give it to them?
No. Well, there were a lot of folk singers around.
Okay, now you were talking about there's politics involved in that. Didn't you create some sort of effort to get the cabaret licenses at that point in time?
Oh, that's a long story, David.
That's a long story. You knocked off the Eichmann trial off the front of the New York Times with what
that's
you did.
That's another story.
You're going to have to come back to tell us these stories.
Let me finish my litany.
Go ahead, swing.
Yeah, okay. Joni Rivers, Joan Baez, Peter Tork. You know who Peter
Sure, for the Monkees.
From the Monkees. Renee Taylor, Dino Valenti, who played with Quicksilver.
Oh, sure.
He was a great, a little Italian guy. I remember he was a volatile guy, too. He played for me for a long time, and he was big time. But I brought a gorgeous young folk singer lady, girl, in.
By the name of?
That eludes me at the moment. But anyway, Dino and she became more than friends. Anyway, there came a time when Dino showed up and he said, "Manny, I don't have a guitar tonight." He said, "Something was stolen to disappear." So I quick went out and I bought him a nice guitar. You know,
how much did a guitar cost back then?
Probably $500. You know, he couldn't play a cheap guitar. So he's playing the guitar and the folk singer lady is off stage there. And she's flirting around with somebody. Dino comes off of the stage, and he takes my $500 guitar, and he starts smashing it across the table to make a point.
Because it's to demonstrate his love, right?
Yeah. I said, "Dino, what are you doing?" Well, anyway, I forget the end of that story. But
tell me the bathtub story. Don't you have a bathtub story you wanted to relate? Go for it. We got a few more minutes.
Well,
here.
I had the premises right next door to where the Cafe Wa was. That became the Comedy Cellar. That's Comedy Cellar.
That's there right now. That's where all the new young comics come out of right now.
And I was doing kind of a crazy theme over there. I had an empty bathtub we'd hauled in off the street, not connected, put it up on the stage. And you could lie in it, you could stand in it, you could sit in it, you could perform in it. And it was another room. It was an accessory to the Café Wa. And we used to party there at night. And we went in there, and there was one night where a bunch of us were partying. And we had our share of kibble and grape nuts. And somebody brought in a little acid, hard.
LSD.
LSD.
What year was this?
Oh, this had to be mid-60s.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were in the bathtub.
We're in the bathtub. Things were going well. Things were going well. Till about 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, the sun's coming up, and all of a sudden, the door crashes in. And here's this big hulking figure saying, "I'm the exterminator."
Was it really the exterminator?
It was really the exterminator.
Did you hallucinate this, Manny?
No. True story, David. True story. Anyway, to get on with my list of people here, there's Dino Valente. I'll tell you who was around and came in and did occasional sets. Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, Janis Joplin, Judy Collins, Simon and Garfunkel, Stiller and Vera.
All of these people passed through your place. This was all in your time,
well,
in your element.
Well, these last people I played played at different venues. They play occasionally. They would come in. They were around. Also, then I went on and I did the comedy stop at the top of the gate. But this was later. And who was there? Seinfeld, Ray Romano, Brett Butler, Chris Rock, Dave Chappelle, Joy Behar.
Oh, now wait.
Bill Hicks.
This is the club that you went and started a period of time later. Still kept your hand in with all of those people.
Yeah.
You're going to have to come back and tell us about all those people. I want to hear all the update stories of all that's familiar on the television next time.
Well, can I ask you to ask me about Bill Hicks the next time we come around?
Absolutely. Bill Hicks has since passed away. Is that true?
Yeah.
He was one of the most forward-thinking comics just recently. Everybody knows who that is. Did you work with Bill?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Bill was the greatest.
Why was he the greatest?
Bill went deeper than anybody.
What do you mean deeper?
Here, let me read you what...
Tell me what you mean by deeper.
Okay.
We got to get ourselves moving.
Okay,
here.
I'll read you this little... Brett Butler summed it up very succinctly here. For all the talk about being like Hendrix or Dylan or Jim Morrison or Lenny Bruce, it was Jesus Bill wanted to be. He wanted to save us all.
He went deeper, huh?
Yeah.
Manny Roth, my uncle, patriarch of the Roth family, reason I got into show business. Manny, I love you to death. These are the most coolest stories ever in the history that you've had, a life of adventure and showbiz and everything in between. I think the city owes a lot to you, and I know I do. Ladies and gentlemen, Manny Roth. Go ahead and break out into your thing here, man.
David Lee Roth, Mornings.
Roth, 6 a.m., alarmingly consistent. First thing in the morning, 866-313-3733. Give us a call. We'll talk about anything that's on your mind. www.davidleeroth.com or thedavidleerothshow.com. We're on the internet as well. Our very special guests, Brian Young is here. Play it up, baby. Let me hear him play with that track. Give me some solo one time. Oh, there it is. And my very special guest, Manny Roth, the patriot of the David, my family. Manny Roth, 86 years old and still cooking. Wow. So
amazing guy.
And Marlise, his wife, was here. You know, that list of names that he just read there is, what did he read? Maybe 4 or 5 names out of a list of 70 or 80 there. Most people don't realize that Manny... took a break from showbiz and then in the 80s started another place and booked all of the Seinfelds and the Bill Hickses and everybody that you, those names that you just heard there. He kind of surfed through 3 or 4 different generations. And besides that, who knows anybody who got laid for the first time in 1928? who even knows anybody like that who would even talk about that? How many people have an uncle that age who would even talk about taking acid in the bathtub and being the Duke of McDougal during the entire folk scene? You know, what is it, The Mighty Wind? You've seen that. That's, you know, in reference to that time period, man. Bob Dylan, Joan Baez, these are interesting names. For me, that was not the record collection that I was always interested in, but that was the lifestyle. The sunlight bores the daylights out of me, like the Stone song says, you know, wait till the sun goes down. And then all that hang. And it sounds exactly like the life that we've lived on the road. We exchanged a city for many, many cities on the road. I probably played 200 cities in the United States. And the parts that you remember the most, unless something goes completely wrong and the PA blows up or somebody, you know, gets hurt during a show or whatever, the stuff that you remember the most is the hang before and after, is the hotel before and after. It's the truck stops and everything that goes with that. And it's the people who, you know, make their way around that music. Classic stuff, eh?
And he really just scratched the surface, don't you think?
Well, it's a long damn story, you know. And in a world of radio, you know, where you're constantly cutting for breaks and whatever. Keep in mind, there was no alcohol involved this morning. I mean, well, not with him. No, you know, think about it in the setting, you know. These studios here, you know, are a thing of the past. These studios are leftovers from Cousin Brucey or whatever. You know, this is party in a dentist office. How are you going to have, you know, bring in a civilian or somebody who's not used to this and he's going to break into song instantly? This is, you know, this environment here. Right away, you got to fix the lighting. Can we fix the lighting in here? Could you do that? We got to get what I call complexion lighting, man, so that no matter what you've been eating for breakfast for 3 weeks, you'll look like Tom Cruise, huh? Want to go to a track? Give it up for a little bit of music. Roth, 6 a.m. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this. David Lee, live in front of your naked, steaming eyes. Give us some solo one time there, bad boy. That's our guy. That's live in the studio, man.
David Lee Roth Noir. Você sente a energia. é o David no rádio às 6 da manhã. You are connected to David Lee Roth. Prepare for combustion.
Roth, 6 a.m., 866-313-FREE. Give us a call. What's on your mind? Did you make a New Year's resolution? Have you already broken your New Year's resolution? What language was she just speaking in there? Take a guess.
Was it Portuguese? No.
Fala suficiente português, não me. That's going to be the third language of the United States, man. Spanish is the I come from Mexifornia. Come on, this is, you know.
Portuguese is such a beautiful language too. It's romantic.
Good looking girls too. I had a great looking girlfriend, man. When Van Halen first went down to Rio de Janeiro, I fell in love with a great little gal named Paula Amaral, and I kept saying to myself, "This is going to be a wonderful place to go." It was really cheap. One flight straight there, no big deal, moving through airports, et cetera, et cetera. And I could never get the band to ever get on the plane to go back on, man. Oh, it's too far. All the toilet water swirls the other way in the bowl. It's below the equator. And the mosquitoes are speaking something that sounds like Spanish. I had a great time, man. I got myself a teacher, and three times a week I'd sit up in the Van Halen offices and I'd take private lessons in Portuguese. I can completely get us in trouble and almost halfway out in Portuguese, but I can do it in Spanish too. What happened is I hurt my back a number of summers ago, and I was really laid up. You know, everything that I was normally, you know, up for going for, you know, let's go camping, let's go climbing, or, you know, whatever, was kind of out of the question for quite a while there. So I went back to school as opposed to, you know, reclusing or, you know, feeling sorry for myself. I said, great, this will be an opportunity. If I can only sit in one place, then we'll do things that only require sitting, and maybe we'll take it a little bit more than computer games or what have you. And I started to learn Spanish as well. Hablo suficiente español para hablar contigo solamente la lengua. And especialmente aquí, you know, here we got Boricua. It's a very different kind of slang, man. And we're speaking to Dallas, Texas, which is Mexicano. Oye, este. That sounds familiar to you, doesn't it? that's the Los Angeles groove, man. The lowrider groove. To this day, I drive a 51 Mercury lowrider, and you know what? Yes, I did have it shipped here, and I will start driving it when the weather's appropriate. Do we have a call? Oh, it's Pauly. Put Pauly up on here. Go ahead and duck the loop down there. Pauly, are you there? Making a phone call?
Great.
Are we making any kind of sense?
Oh, it sounds awesome, man. It sounds awesome. Listen, you got to invite Uncle Manny up to Ryan this week or next week, depending on the weather.
Okay, this is Paulie Tramontana, who's my flight instructor. Just recently, I passed my final FAA exam, both written and practical, for turbine helicopter. And I go flying 3-4 times a week. Paulie is the reason that I even know how to even open up the door. Tell you, am I a decent pilot, Paulie?
I tell you, brother, it's incredible what you've accomplished for me in the last 2 years. You know, coming back from listening to you with Jump and Van Halen, I'm just so proud of you, man. It's awesome what you accomplished with me.
Well, I told you in the martial arts, the most serious compliment that you'll ever get from one of the old Japanese masters that I learned from in Kendo or Karate is, oh, you have a great teacher.
That means a lot to me, Dave. And let's, like I said, let's invite Uncle Manny up flying. We'll show him what New York looks like at 3,000 feet.
You know what? I'm going to tell you a little something about Uncle Manny. Being a navigator in a Memphis Belle B-17 during the bombing of Berlin, and he doesn't like to talk about it a whole lot. He was involved in the bombing of Dresden. He was involved in bombing of Munich and a whole lot of others. He did 25 missions. And the last thing Manny Roth wants to get into is anything that leaves the ground. He passed on Martin Scorsese, you know, when they did the retrospective or the tribute to Bob Dylan, and there was the documentary and everything. And it's true, Bob Dylan first came to Manny at the Cafe Wa, January 24th, 1961. That's the first place that he played. He hadn't even changed his name yet. He was Bob Zimmerman, like that. And the publicity firm from the Scorsese people called up and said, you have to come to the opening. There's going to be an opening in New York City, you know, with the red carpet and the red velvet rope and the press and everything. And Manny's response was, will I meet Martin Scorsese? And they said, well, sir, probably not. He said, I've already met Dylan, man. Come on. But what happened is also we found for a birthday present not terribly long ago, up around Cornell, I think it is, there is a place where you can get into a B-17. The Memphis Belle, where the nose sits up, you know, and they'll give you the jacket, you know, the big sheepskin jacket, you know, and the Snoopy hat and whatever, because they don't have heating. I don't even think they have air pressurization or whatever. And Manny wanted no part of it. He had done his time, much the way I feel about drum solos, Paulie. But you know what? What we're talking about is. I started flight lessons, about a year and a half ago, and most difficult thing I've ever done. I thought EMT was going to be a struggle. I tell you, I was doing my finals on the FAA written exam. It takes 2.5 hours to do that final. It took me 2.5 hours just to go for the exam. Paulie and I trained. We studied. He was my senior instructor, and we crammed, 8 hours Sunday, 8 hours Monday, 8 hours Tuesday, 8 hours Wednesday after I did the Howard Stern interview. I was sitting in the other room just, you know, whatever this was, a month ago or whatever, and Howard's going, hey, what do you never know how tough radio is. Oh, you know, you're going to have this and do that. And I'm 10 minutes later, I was back in ground school, correcting pressure, density, altitude for temperature variation at 120 knots.
It was incredible. The only thing that got us through that, Dave, is knowing that we were going to have the two chicks in the toaster oven at the end of the show.
Single most awesome experience I've ever had flying like that. When you're in a helicopter, that's the closest. Hey, I'm a freaking gull. Yeah, you're like a seagull. You can wheel and turn, and it's the most amazing thing. And for me, growing up in the Vietnam era, watching on television, everything was, you know, that's MASH, the Bell 47, landing and picking up all those soldiers, you know. And as you can tell from my family here, you know, that element of adventure always comes first in the Roth family. My father was in the Air Force, was stationed as a flight surgeon in Casablanca. Uncle Dave was in the Air Force, you know, on and on. It's been my cousins and everything. And this is kind of a circle back around. Maybe at some point, you know, I can dovetail the two. And I don't know, what do you do with helicopter? First off, you take it right over the Empire State Building and see what King Kong saw from the top there. What's amazing trick. I'm talking to Paulie Tramontano, my flight instructor here. What are we going to do? When do you want to go flying next, Paulie?
We're going to see if the weather breaks. Maybe tomorrow we can go up. I'll talk to you a little later. And listen, Dave, for me and all of the pilots at Liberty, we all wish you great luck, and we can't wait to see you again.
God bless. Paulie, have a great day. Paulie Tramontano, my flight instructor.
All right, brother. Bye.
Show enough. Do you want to play a track?
Well, sure. Give me one. I'll play it for you.
We never even picked a track, did we?
No, you can.
To hell with it. Pick another call.
We're almost at the end of the show. We can talk. We take another call. Why not?
What, you got one last call? Yeah,
sure.
Who do we got? 866-313-3733. Who's on the line? We lost the line?
Hello?
Hello?
Is it David?
Scream a little louder, sweetie. Who is this?
David, it's Jennifer Koppelman. Hi, how are you? You're doing so great.
Oh, Jennifer. This is Charles Koppelman's daughter. Oh, this is royalty. This is New York City royalty.
Dave, I'm not royalty. I'm your sister's friend.
Yeah, your family is one of the linchpins of this whole city here. Jennifer, what are you doing these days? Are you working? Or are you loafing?
Actually, I co-host a radio show on, you know, Sirius, but we don't have to talk about that.
No, I want to talk about it. What kind of show do you host? This is fascinating.
I host every day from 12 to 2 on Sirius Satellite on Martha Stewart's channel, whatever, and I co-host with Alexa Stewart, Martha's daughter.
And does she have any brains?
Oh, my God, she's incredible. She's
no, that's
so
not
funny.
What I asked. I asked, does she have any brains?
She's very smart, Dave, just like you.
No, I'm not. I'm a safe distance from genius, Jennifer.
Let me tell you, no, you're not. When I was in college, I went to one of your shows. I don't know if you remember. And I went backstage, and we hung out for like 3 hours, and you didn't stop talking during the entire 3 hours about, I don't even know what. I couldn't even understand it. And I went to a smart school.
Oh, okay. First off, that you didn't understand it is not unusual. You can check with the rhythm section on that one.
Second of off, Uncle Manny.
Second of off, If I talked to you for 3 hours, then, hey, those were the party days, and who knew, huh? Rehab was something you sent Uncle Bob to. Go ahead and bring her back in here. Mm-hmm. She's used to screaming over the rest of her family. Jennifer, are you still there?
I'm still here.
And how long have you been working on satellite radio, Jennifer?
I've been working on satellite radio about 3 months, and it's great.
And are you like on talk radio? Is that it? You're the talk station. Fascinating, because to me, yourself and Stern aside, what most satellite radio is kind of like an oldies archive. And it's sort of like Vincent Price, okay, where there's House of Wax, and they set up 1,000 categories, all right?
Uh-huh.
And disc jockeys from around the world are being kidnapped and disappearing, and nobody knows where they went, okay? And we've got the Cuban Tropical disc jockey, and he's embalmed in one little alcove. And then you've got the guy who does retro fusion pop, and he's right in a little box right next to him, embalmed. And right next to that is the guy who does heavy metal, but only until the year 1982 from 1973, the summer. And then there's the guy who's next, and next to it, and next to it. And as far as doing research, it's spectacular. You know, if you want to go and check through, it's like a time period. You don't need a time machine. It's either Nickelodeon on the television, or there's a time frame for that. But I find that what's lacking in populist radio and telecommunications in general is, where's the person who's going to help me figure out what to listen to that's new, that's unexpected, because I don't want to categorize anymore. What happens with satellite radio is I find I do extreme surfing. It's so rich. It's like one of those Scheffenberger chocolate bars where you can only absorb 3 bites and then it's too much. So I start surfing. I can only listen to a specified diet. If they say this is heavy metal, only 1980 till 1988 or whatever, how many bites of that can you take? 3, and you hit the button, you surf. And that little monkey inside of me is always wondering, God, you got so many other channels, man. Don't you want to check out what's on the Luna channel? And that's kind of cute. And hey, well, don't you want to check out the, you get stations with names like Fred and Bobby in earnest. And it's like Vincent Price, the House of Wax. Not you, sweetie. Certainly not Stern. Certainly not a handful of others, but a handful enough. I don't know if a handful is enough to make me want to go and buy satellite. Are we going to go to get the spots right here one time?
Actually, Dave, it's almost 10 o'clock.
Well, let's quit early, and it'll really freak Gisano out. Roth, 6 a.m., 866-313-3733. You can give us a call tomorrow, 6 in the morning till 10, 5 days a week. My first office job, Diamond Dave's Tiki Bunker, where the debris meets the sea. Oye, miro. Join me tomorrow. It gets nothing but better from here. Oh, yeah, nothing but yeah.
David Lee Roth in the mornings.